Ladies and gentlemen, you're very welcome to the first edition of the Huddle Podcast. My name is Ronan and I'll be your host today. And the reason we decided to start this podcast is basically to share stories from the software testing and wider community. So both the development community and then in the wider software development community cycle. And our first guest I'm very pleased to announce today joining me is from the West Coast of the United States is Ray Arell. Ray, hello.
Hello, how are you today?
Not too bad, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to be here on the kickoff episode.
Good, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I think you're a great person to start with in terms of you have a long career in the tech industry and spanning over 30 years. But perhaps maybe we might start maybe sort of, for people that are not aware of you, just a general background, what sort of what you're doing now and where you are and what you're working on.
Sure. So, I mean, if you look at my my background, I've been in the industry for about 35 years. I don't, you know, once you get above a couple of decades, you know, it gets to be a bit of a blur. Today, I'm actually running a consultancy. That consultancy is called New Agility, and it's a company that's focused on helping teams to basically take advantage of the learning that I've had over the last 5 to 10 years on how to do agile development within large corporations. That includes anything from how do I not just do it, you know, with a 12-person team, but how do we actually do that where we have a 5,000-person team or larger? How do we actually integrate this in a way that enables us to be able to be actually take advantage of the agile mindset and the different methods that are available? Beyond that, I also do a podcast myself. It's something called the Agile Coaching Network. It's done bi-weekly, and that's a nonprofit entity that's where we're just sort of giving back to the community good things that we might be learned as well, get a worldview and a world perspective together to be able to talk about how you might do a natural adoption, say, in India versus maybe Germany or even in Ireland where you're at.
That's very interesting. I suppose for our community, as is, Huddle is a community of software testers, they will be interested in your role as in Agile, obviously, as an Agile coach and Agile leader. But maybe we might start before that, pre-Agile.
Sure.
Yeah, what were you doing then and sort of how did they transition to Agile come about?
Sure. So if you look at my first steps into Agile, that happened roughly about 10 years ago. So, you know, probably about 2 years or so after the manifesto was signed was the first time that as a development manager at the time that we actually stepped into saying maybe we should be using more of an iterative approach versus a waterfall approach to delivery. To give you at least a little bit of background about my test career, I actually started off at Intel Corporation as a design engineer for microprocessors, but I moved over into something called validation architecture. And specifically, how can we create test blocks within microprocessors in order to ensure that the device was working correctly. If you're not familiar with, you know, how complicated a microprocessor is, not every test probe comes out, not every single bit that we could go off and look at isn't available. And if you look at the permutations of tests that you would have on any of the given instruction set that you would have with the microprocessor, that was a very complex animal that we had to go tackle. And so I joined over and started to look at ways that we could actually improve the way that we test within that space. And that actually, for a number of years, was a big focus of mine. So if anyone goes and does a, you know, kind of a Google on me, you'll probably find that I used to go attend things like, you know, and speaker at things like Eurostar or Stans or the Agile testing days, those things, because there's a lot of commonality as far as development methodologies of how we develop something and the expectation that development is not just about writing the line of code, but it's actually completing it by also testing the line of code as well.
That's interesting. That was your role for, you were there for a few years, were you?
Well, with Intel, I was actually there almost 30 years.
So you're a long time there. My focus on your Agile then. So when the manifesto came out or when it was signed, did you see the, were you a convert, I suppose, so I don't know if that's the right word, straight away. What do you think about it? Or even the before it was the manifesto came out, like what were your thoughts? You had you had enough with the water with waterfall as you thought, did you think like that there is some there should be a better way?
Well, when I first so if you look at my career inside of this big Fortune 100 company, I spent a lot of time not just in the development space, but as I grew in my, because I started in engineering and then I eventually went into management, okay. I was actually helping with writing some of the big policies of how we actually deliver product at the company. And so I actually wrote one of the waterfall standards for Intel. So if you look at my back, very familiar with, you know, how we set up, you know, this funnel. And that's the picture you can draw in your mind of what we had. And we had, you know, the exploration, you know, the going down to development and then eventually test. And the reason why waterfall was prominent in the semiconductor company is because, you know, when you compile a piece of silicon, which is actually software, you know, the behavioral language that we would use to be able to go create a processor, looks like C code. And then it compiles by this big thing called a microprocessor fabrication plant, a fab. And then eventually we get something we can test. And the waterfall fit us at the time because, you know, we couldn't just compile a piece of silicon and then test it right away. We actually had to wait weeks. And so we kind of grew up through this manufacturing culture, and then we tried to adopt manufacturing culture directly into our software development, because Intel in its early days was a microprocessor company. Intel, when I left, was a solutions company, meaning that they were delivering all of the stack. You know, you weren't just getting a microprocessor from them. You're also getting the software that, you know, drivers, different OS configurations, and a whole bunch of other things that are piled on top. And what we were discovering was when we became the solutions provider that we could, one, be more iterative, especially at the upper layers of the stack. But, you know, not just we could, but our customers were starting to demand that we were more iterative, you know, and more responsive to the needs. And so the journey into Agile started with us having some really, you know, frank conversations between us and our customers about them wanting more of a hand in telling us what types of requirements that they wanted. They wanted it more iterative. They wanted it to, you know, as much as we could provide them more capabilities. As you know, that's a very complex thing. But, you know, we couldn't do that with waterfall because those cycles were just too long.
Yeah. And so were you involved then in adapting Agile there at Intel? How's the timeline fit?
Oh, it actually was inside of Intel.
Okay.
And when it started, there were two small groups of people that decided to go off and do the first implementations of Agile in the company. One of them was one of my teams, and then there was another peer within Intel that was also doing it as well. I was a member of something called the Software Directors Council, which is where all of the software directors of the company came together and talked about how they were trying to go improve the development process of software. And I can remember the first time that I said we were using Agile practices, and they were not happy. You know, this wasn't a happy time to say that, you know, we were trying to go use this methodology, because it was one, it wasn't really well known at the time, and it went against those governance and those policies that we had originally, you know, put in place. And so it took a few years for us to build credibility with, you know, both the technical practices that we put into the Agile development, as well as how does iterative development fit into maybe a bigger waterfall structure that's above it? Because delivery of you know, my components was just one piece of 28 to 30 other different components that came together to make a PC. So
yeah.
So it took probably about 4 to 5 years later that it really started to take off as a prominent way of doing development. And at that time, we went from roughly around 100 people doing development in the very beginning to we went up to 3,000 people doing agile development a couple of years later. And I was asked by our executive vice president to actually take over a coaching group, you know, give up my development life and actually run the agile adoption at Intel. And so I did that for about four to five years, where I was helping teams coach and mentor them on how to do agile development at the company.
So yeah, I was actually just wondering there, like when you talk about at the start, was how big was your team to start with?
Well, we first started with one team who asked to do it. So I mean, it was that first Scrum team of 12 people, and then it became two Scrum teams, and then it became, you know, four Scrum teams. And by the time that I left Intel, which was last year, we had well over 800 Scrum teams.
Wow, that's huge. So that's a big big adaption of the process. And I suppose that's where your lot of experience comes now in large scale adaption. And in terms of how Intel adopted it, it sounds like it was just basically a team by team process, isn't in terms of it, that's the way it worked, is in smaller teams adapted and it moved on like in that regards, rather than going from the top down, went from the bottom up. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it was more or less, as I used to describe it, a groundswell of activity, which if you look at, you know, innovative environments, one of the best things that you can have is innovations coming from not just, you know, from on high and then down, but innovations that are taking place on the way that we do development at the grassroots level. The challenge with grassroots, as you know, though, becomes funding. You know, how do we get those teams what they need in order to be successful in actually practicing these methods? And so when we got to that, what I considered to be the tipping point, which was we now had 3,000 people using the practices, having a conversation with senior management, you know, executive management at that point was, you really can't tell them to stop. You know, we've got 3,000 people having success. They need more help. How do we get them more help? And by doing that, now we had the executives come in and saying, I see the benefit with the stuff that I typically measure. You know, time to market was getting better, quality was getting better, employee retention and happiness was getting better. I mean, if you look at all the standard C-suite metrics, they couldn't deny that what they were seeing was a better way of approaching things. So after they gave that support and we started putting in, you know, more coaches in the environment to be able to help, we went up to 25,000 people that were using it. So it was a fairly wide adoption at that point.
Wow, that is huge. And I'm just curious, how does that compare or contrast to what you do now? As you said, your work agile development and your focus is on the large scale adoptions of agile. So if, for example, if you're brought in now to a company, are you brought in working from the top down now, or do you still approach it from a bottom up process? How do you approach it now, adoption, like compared to approach it then?
It's a bit of a mix. You know, if you look at most agile adoptions that you see happening in industry, it's typically a CTO, someone at that level who looks at and says, we need to change the way that we're doing development. And agile, you know, if you look at where it's at now in the scope of things, of methodologies, then it tends to be one of the first things that people reach for. The issues that happen, whether or not if it's done at a 12-person team or a 5,000-person team, is that it's a huge cultural shift. And so some companies, and I'll point to like companies like Spotify as an example. Spotify started as an Agile company. And so their challenges tend to be more, how do we scale? You know, and they hit the same problems that, you know, we had like at Intel. Intel had 162 sites worldwide. How do we do an Agile adoption in India? How do we do an Agile adoption in Norway? How do we do an Agile adoption in Ireland or other countries? The base culture does affect, and the company culture especially, affects whether or not we can suddenly start to say, can teams be self-organizing? And what we typically work probably more with is not, you know, I can teach Scrum to anybody in about 10 minutes. Changing the culture that, you know, of now having, in the case of big companies, they tend to be more command and control oriented. The manager hands tasks out and all these other things that you would see in a command and control culture. That we spend more time actually having to teach and unlearn some of those habits of command and control and turning back over some of that control back to the development team. And that's a difficult thing for some people to give up control.
That's interesting. And I'm curious in terms of, generally speaking, in terms of adaption of Agile, because it's become, I wouldn't say ubiquitous now, but it's become quite a popular development process, that if you're going into a company, for example, are you finding that people are, if you're going talking to a development team, that if they're not already doing some sort of Agile process, or there may be some waterfall or some other process, that they are, you might find that they people like in the development team or testing team are eager to adopt Agile, whereas it might be different from a management viewpoint? Or is it, do you find any difference of opinion across the board in terms of people's opinions?
Well, I think in any type of adoption of any methodology, there's really a base of first, what's the culture like in the company? Meaning, have they tried to do other adoptions of something else and they failed? You know, and let's face it, when you're a consultant, you're rarely brought in because everything's going good, you know.
Yes.
You're typically brought in at that, we've got a problem and we need to fix it. And there's different, you know, countermeasures that we can put in place to go help that. But typically, you walk into something that had went wrong. And so within that, we typically will see kind of a breakdown of people into kind of different camps. One of those would be the visionaries, the people who really want change. Those people are going to be your advocates. They're going to help you. And the middle group, which is, you know, these, you know, early adopters or late adopters, some of them just want, you know, hey, I work here. You know, you tell me what the methodology is. I'll follow it. And those people tend to just go along with, you know, the early majority, and the late majority kind of come along with, you know, the rest of the team. And then we have the laggers, and the laggers are probably the most difficult group. The way that you know a lagger in the system, the person who's going to be the resistance, basically, tends to be the people who acknowledge and ignore you. I acknowledge that you want to go do Agile here, but I'm going to ignore you because I think that this initiative is going to last like every other initiative we've done in the company. It's going to last 1 year, and then there'll be a new initiative. So all I have to do is ignore you for a year. You know, have you seen that pattern?
Yes, I think like everyone would identify that with some way. There's always, I find that I've worked in a number of different roles over the years, that you always have find people, management are keen to adopt something, and you definitely will find, I won't say resistance, but people that are either not as eager to adopt, or they don't view it as either beneficial to their role or as something that's beneficial for either themselves or the company. And yes, I think some people become, if it's the processes have been tried a number of times, so you see people's skepticism about it. But I can imagine, do you find it hard or easy to win people over, or do you try win people over?
Well, I don't really trying to win people over. I typically look for small successes, meaning that most times when you do a big initiative, people tend to go and say, this is the biggest problem that we have, and we're going to go tackle the biggest problem, and it's going to take us 32 weeks or, you know, longer to go fix this problem, but we're going to go tackle that one because that's the one that we think we're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar out. And those are okay, but I tend to say, what can we change today or maybe in the next couple of days that's going to make our life here better? And have those really fast wins. And as people start to win and feel that they're gaining momentum, you know, if I make a 1% change this week and another 1% change the next week and another 1% change the following week, and I get out 52 weeks, I've got, hey, I got 52% change.
Yes.
To me, that's better. It also helps to raise attitudes that what we're doing is actually, you know, of benefit.
Has there ever been companies that have adopted online that it isn't for them?
Has there ever been the case where Agile hadn't fit or it wasn't the right methodology for development within the team? And the answer is yes.
Yes.
And the answer is yes. So there are certain cases where I think that people sometimes say the destination that we're going for is Agile, and they make that the destination. I think that's the wrong approach for any adoption of any methodology. What people need to look at is to say, what methodology is right for us to be able to meet these business goals? You know, whether it be, again, you know, happiness of the employees to, you know, time to market to quality, whatever those measurements that we would typically go off and say, these are the things we need to improve for our customer or for to be able to make this a great place to work. Agile can be a way of doing that. Are there other methods that can be applied that can do the same? Sure. And in certain cases, I see teams like practicing Scrum, and I ask them, okay, Scrum says that every, you know, 2 to 4 weeks, you're going to be in front of your customer giving a demo. And some of those people will say, well, my customer doesn't want a demo, you know, every 2 to 4 weeks. And so I ask, well, who are you demoing it to? And they say, well, nobody. Well, is Scrum the right approach at that point?
Yes.
So there's a change that has to happen in any of these methods that, you know, as I connect to my customers. And I can remember my first conversation with one of the bigger OEMs that we were shipping product to. And I said, I need your test team, because we would test internally ourselves, and they would integrate and then retest in their environment. And they had completely different test environments than we do. They found cool things that we never found just because of the way that, you know, they had their things configured. And we couldn't duplicate some of those things because they were too expensive to duplicate internal to us. So we would say, we're going to drop something to you every 2 weeks, and the obligation that you guys have is you have to give us feedback. And I remember that the first time I said that, they go, hey, we're not equipped to do that. And I had to go over the benefits of why that was important to them. And it took probably a good, 5 months for them to suddenly see, hey, if I actually tell them that there's a problem, I don't have to go through the typical defect tracker and the typical negotiation to getting this thing fixed. I can get it fixed in the next drop. So
yes. There
was sort of a re-education that had to take place there. So I hope that answers your question. But, you know, again, methods need to fit what we're trying to do in the market. You know, it's how we win customers. How do we support them?
Just you mentioned Scrum there. As I was doing a bit of research for this talk, I came across a talk you gave in 2015. It was a keynote, the BTD conference, and it was Scrum Must Die.
Yes.
So you mentioned Scrum there, so I'm just curious, you might explain maybe what the talk was about.
Sure. You always got to pick a provocative title, right?
Yeah.
And in this particular case, I was standing, I used to run internal Agile conferences at the company, and we had James Grinning, who's one of the signatories of the Agile Manifesto, and he was the inventor of something called Planning Poker. And there was a method that he came up with cards where people could size up, you know, user story. And he was, you know, it was before he went up and took his keynote, I was talking with him and just, you know, having a conversation. And he said, you know, if I knew that 5 years after I introduced planning poker to somebody and they were still using it, that I would, you know, I would have never invented the game in the first place, because planning poker was only supposed to last until people learned how to do better planning, and then you didn't need the cards anymore. But he said, you know, he noticed that people use those cards too much. And so when he said that, I got to thinking about Scrum, and it's sort of the same thing, which Scrum teaches us some really good practices. It defines some good roles, the different artifacts that we would have for it. But when we teach somebody Scrum and then we come back five years later and they're still just using just plain Scrum and they haven't evolved and made it better, I think that we miss the point of what Agile is. Agile should be evolutionary, both on the product side as well as the team side. And so when I said Scrum must die, I was referring to the fact that if you've used Scrum for 5 years, you should, you know, it should just go away. You should be now continuous delivery. You should be with new methods. You should have upgraded yourself as a continuous learning organization. And so that whole talk was focused on, hey, you have to expand your horizon. Yes, use the mistraining wheels. You know, Scrum's a great, you know, thing that you would teach somebody to, you know, drive a bike. But then afterwards, take the training wheels off. Go do some new thing.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. And just on that, I'm just curious, what's your opinion or thoughts on, like, I won't say we're in a post-agile world now, but we're getting there. What are your thoughts on this new process that have sort of come above the surface recently, like BDD and TDD? How do you think they fit into their relationship with Agile? And maybe secondly, where do you think it's going? Is it if we do end up in a post-agile world?
Yeah, I've heard the post-agile for a while. I think if you look at, you know, the Agile, you know, the umbrella term, you know, what fits underneath an Agile umbrella. There's a lot of different methods that fit underneath. If you look at test-driven development as a great thing that Agile teams can do in order to be able to one, fix this problem that we've been talking about for, gosh, probably since the 60s. Oh, the requirement's bad. Well, if I were to write the test first, you know, and then I develop to pass the test, those types of methods actually, I think, are very beneficial, because, as you know, in the very beginning, if I'm only dealing with maybe, you know, 5,000 lines of code, it's not really that big of a deal if I don't have all those tests in place to go check to see whether or not I'm still good. But when I get to, you know, 1,000,000 lines of code, boy, I better have some tests in place to verify that as new people come into the code base, that it actually is working, and being able to have a methodology of both of the ones that you mentioned, be able to put the rigor that's necessary. And I think people ignore sometimes, having been in that validation architecture space and known some really great people with huge test brains, meaning people that could literally, if I said, I think this works perfectly, and then they put one finger on it and break it. You know, it's that type of mindset of being able to one, if I had to think about the simple stuff that we do in test, which is, this is what the spec says, test to that spec, this is the output that I get, this is the output I should expect from the system, from the workload, this should be the output from the workload. By using those methodologies, I can put all of that stuff up front, and I can use those great testers that, you know, can find these marvelous failure conditions that we would have never expected. I want to free up their time. You know, I want to automate all of the kind of the basics, and I want to shift the tester brains now over to finding these really big problems that we've never expected that would occur.
Very interesting, actually. I don't want to keep you for too much longer, Ray. I'm conscious of your time. So probably finally, you're speaking at Odinstar.
Yes.
And you're talking about innovation and leading innovation there, and how that fits. And what's your reasons for talking about this? A person can become the innovation leader. Curious, like, why you call it innovation leader, maybe, and how does the innovation leader differ from the project manager? Are they two different people?
They can be the same person. I think the reason why I went down this road of innovation, and it was a couple of years ago that I started to see some anti-patterns coming into existence, which was, you know, and it's sort of like in the Scrum Must Die, you know, once I've reached mastery of something, can I break the rules? What does the governance system that we have say about how do we innovate and move forward on something? And we had some executives in our company that said, hey, we need more innovations. And they were throwing these words out. And I had to really think about what environment have we created that truly would allow somebody to be innovative? You know, and it's sort of like, are you a Star Trek fan at all?
Well, I watch the Next Generation, I'm afraid. That's what generation I am. So I wouldn't know of it. Yeah, the universe and everything.
Well, you remember Sulu, right? You know,
he's
the Helms officer. And there was one Captain Kirk was sitting there and he asked for orders. What direction, sir? And, you know, Captain Kirk said, you know, indulge yourself, you know, and allowed him the ability to go off and find something cool. You know, and innovation in a lot of regards, I think that what happens is that we get so focused on the big goal that we have. There is no time that's in the system to allow people to go off and innovate. And if I put 110% of my workday to the delivery of this product, then I don't have enough time to suddenly go and just discover new things. Now, that's not to say that we can't find innovations in what we do in our own workbench. I think that there's a certain mindset that needs to come into teams that allows them to be able to look at and understand what's their empowerment of how we can go innovate. And that's anything from vision statements that leaders give to what is the overall environment that we work around? Is there dollars available? Is there time available? You know, all of the above. And those are the things that I want to really see kind of come in more into focus. And so I've been talking in this space because I think that we do innovation wrong today. In big businesses especially.
All right. And are you talking about like traditional businesses or are you talking about like tech businesses? I know because you often hear that the big tech companies, especially the ones born in less than 15 years old, they almost every second word is from statements from them is all about innovation and giving their staff the space to work and to discover and things like that. So do you mean traditional or are you talking about new stuff?
Well, I think it's a combo. I mean, I had a person a long time ago tell me that you're going to have three types of CEOs in your life. And the first CEO is typically the innovator. He or she is the person who had the original product idea that got the business off the ground. And their mindset typically always remains in that, hey, what's another cool thing that I can go work on?
Yeah.
The second person who takes over after the innovator, it's typically as the company is growing, is the accountant. And that person's mindset is more about how do I build value for the shareholders? And that could be anything from efficiencies and other things that I can go with my organization to help it to run leaner and may constrict the ability for the organization to now be innovative. And that switchover happens with most companies. I mean, I see it with some of the cooler new companies that we see out there. Their biggest struggle happens when that transition occurs to where now we're kind of reporting to the street. By the way, the third type of CEO you might get is the lawyer. And the lawyer typically goes off and is looking for opportunities to sell chunks of the business or acquire different chunks of business instead of growing people internally. We want to go into that market. Well, I look at everyone that I have here and the skill sets that I have. It would be faster to go buy that company than it would be to train up and do it here. And I think, you know, again, as the company matures, that if you're lucky enough to stay with that first culture, then I think you do well. But I think most companies are suffering from either having the accountant CEO or they have the lawyer or a combo of the two of those that are at the helm. And that unfortunately affects the culture.
Yeah, you actually reminded me there of, I don't know if you watch Silicon Valley, the TV series.
I've seen it, yes.
It's exactly what you said there between series one and series two, I think, of the TV series, exactly as you said about the two different types of CEO, which is just brought a smile to my face because that's exactly what happened. And it was, I know Mike Judge, who's creator, he used to work in Silicon Valley, I think, in the 80s. So he's obviously picked up some of the nuances of how these tech companies grow. Is basically the TV series repeats exactly what you just said there.
Well, I think that's a challenge for most engineers, right? Because
yeah.
I think the one line that stuck out to me in that show was when,
yeah.
and I don't remember the characters' names, I apologize, but he was talking to the CEO and talking about their cool product, and the CEO looked at him and said, "You don't understand. That's not my product. My product is the stock price." That realization to understand that what executive management focused on, what's our numbers to the street? And that's such a huge gap between I'm building this really cool thing that people I think will want to buy to a person who's at the complete opposite of the universe going, you know, how do I deliver it for as cheap as possible? And how do I measure between revenue divided by number of employees? That's a huge gap, you know.
Yes, I agree with you. Unfortunately, Ray, I think we'll leave it there because as I said, I don't want to keep too much of your time, but it's fascinating and fascinating to hear your thoughts on innovation. And as I said, you will be presenting at Odinstar, giving a keynote and also a workshop there. So that's taking place in Oslo. So if you'd like to hear or see Ray live, you can go over to odinstar.com and you'll find out more there. Ray, I want to thank you very much for joining me today on the inaugural Huddle podcast, and maybe one day I might have you back. It'd be great to have you back and discuss everything in more detail, because I don't think we covered half as much as we could have covered today.
Thank you. It's been a good conversation.
Great. Thanks very much, Ray.